Hey, everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Saipa, and this week it's just me and Lucas Lajos. Kenny is out celebrating with his girlfriend who just graduated, so congratulations to her. And how's it going, Lucas?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing especially good because later on we're going to get to see the Battle of King's Landing in the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones.
Oh, man. I'm very, so underwhelmed.
I'm excited to see what happens. The second to last episodes have been pretty much the most exciting ones. The first season had Ned Stark's death. Season 2 had the Battle of Blackwater. Season 3 had the Red Wedding. There was the Battle of Castle Black in the next season, the Fighting Pits of Meereen, the Battle of the Bastards, the Battle against the Whites in the North. So pretty much the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones is like the best one. And
that's
the
fair.
The Mets have actually had some pretty exciting penultimate games too. 2007 and 2008 topped the list. Obviously, the next day things didn't work out, but you know, for the 24 hours beforehand, they were live. We had hope. They had momentum. Things are looking good. In 2007, they blew out the Marlins 13-0 with John Mean going 7+ scoreless, and he struck out 14. And then in 2008, Johan carried the team on his back and threw a shutout, and the Mets won 2-0. And in both years, 2007 and 2008, the team had some rookies that made their major league debuts that year. And those are the guys that we are going to promote, extend, or trade. So in 2008, there was a 23-year-old debuting Daniel Murphy.
Oh.
And then in 2007, there is a 21-year-old debuting Carlos Gomez and a 26-year-old debuting Carlos Muniz, relief pitcher. So of those three, who are you going to promote and who are you going to extend? Because I think it's pretty obvious who's going to be traded in this situation.
Carlos Muniz. I don't even remember this name. What?
Yeah. He threw like 6 innings of relief and that was a career, basically.
Huh. Okay, yeah, well, he's gone. He's getting traded.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty much between Murphy and Gomez.
I mean, that's a tough one. Both of these are guys that, like, took time to really figure it out. I guess Murphy was better while he was figuring it out because he always had the contact skills, but, like, he was just a... How good was he? It was just kind of like a whatever two-win player for a while, and then suddenly he realized he could hit for power and started doing that. Gomez was, like, straight up bad for a while.
Yeah.
And then realized he could hit and hit for power. And then his hip got shredded and everything went downhill from there. I think I extend Murphy and I promote Gomez because Murphy's floor and his ceiling were actually higher. So yeah, give me Murphy.
I went the other way. I was gonna extend Gomez and promote Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Gomez is, I mean, obviously, you know, we're dealing with just all hypotheticals, but I think Gomez's ceiling was higher. You know, he had kind of 5-tool ceiling if everything went right and he was developed properly and injuries didn't, you know, negatively impact him. Whereas Murphy just kind of was a higher floor guy that, you know, his ceiling did exponentially increase when they figured out, like, hey, if you just swing with a more of a uppercut to it, you can hit more home runs. Great. But
right.
Gomez is just, you know, his speed, his defense, those things, I think, for me, give him the edge as like a long run kind of player.
Yeah. I mean, I think either choice is really defensible here. Gomez is probably more exciting to watch just for the center field defense. And also Murphy's going to have those like 5 or 6 plays every year where you want to just scream at your TV. So
that's very true too.
Then again, Gomez had plenty of his own donker moments if we think about it. So who knows?
Also true, too. Well, the Syracuse Mets this week went 3-3, and that puts them at 20-15 for the season, which is actually a half game ahead of the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Railriders for first place in the International League North. So we have a first-place team, finally. The Binghamton Rumble Ponies, they went 4-3 and are 19-12, which puts them two games behind the Trenton Thunder for first place in the in the Eastern League Eastern Division. St. Lucie Mets, they went 2-4, which puts them at 18-16 for the season, which is 3.5 games behind the Fort Myer Miracle for first place in the Florida State League South. And finally are the Columbia Fireflies, and they actually had a decent week this week. They went 3-4, so it's still a below 500 record for the week, but it's one of their better ones. And they are now 11-23 for the season, which is 7.5 games behind the Charleston River Dogs for first place in the Sally Southern Division.
I will say at least one of those Fireflies wins. I'm not even sure I want to call it a win. They scored 3 runs in the first inning without an RBI, just on 2 throwing errors, and then had like 1 base runner the rest of the game and won.
Well, a win is a win.
Yeah, I mean, you take it any way you can get it, especially when you're 9-10 and what did you say they were? I'm sorry.
11-23.
11-20. Yeah, not great.
No, not at all. And what makes it worse is that we had so much hope for that team. I was thinking like, oh, they're going to steamroll the division, and
yeah,
not exactly happening.
I mean, Zapuki's been disappointing. Might be borked. Simeon Woods Richardson hasn't been great. Newton was hurt and keeps striking out. Vientos isn't hitting for power. Mauricio is hitting, but not with any, with no substance behind it. The rest of the team is just kind of meh.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Well, the short season teams are going to start opening in about a month, so maybe we're going to see some roster movement.
Yeah, just to start, because we were talking about Newton specifically last week. He now has a strikeout rate under 40%, so maybe he's starting to pull out of this, but I could still see him getting sent to the shorts, like, which isn't like the end of the world. He's still only 20, but I could see them sending him to short season.
Yeah, it's not going to be inappropriate at his age,
right,
in the
right.
New York Penn either. So,
right.
All right. Well, our hitter of the week, someone who is not having such offensive struggles, is actually somebody that we just spoke about, Carlos Gomez. He played in 5 games this week, and for the week, he's hitting .421, .500, .1000 with 8 hits, 2 doubles, 3 home runs. And it is coming on a .455 BABIP, but, you know, when you're hot, that's what happens.
Yep.
He was born in Dominican Republic, Santiago, and long, long, long ago, the Mets signed him for just $20,000. And as an interesting little tidbit, after he signed with the Mets, he wasn't, you know, assigned to a team for basically a year and a half or so. So he was actually a carpenter during that time. And he specialized in making coffins. So very,
that's a little morbid.
Yeah.
But did we ever get any details on why it took him so long to make the transition, or?
Don't know. He was signed in July, towards the end of July in 2002. And then he made his professional debut in Kingsport in the GCL in 2004. So basically a year and a half he was not playing.
That's crazy. I never knew that.
Yeah. So, he made his debut in 2004. He hit a combined .281, .324, .407 with the GCL Mets and Kingsport Mets, which is pretty good. 76 in 120 games. And he impressed the Mets so much with his performance that year and his maturity and his performance during spring training and at the complex and everything, that they skipped him over High A, and they sent him straight to Binghamton in 2006. And he started the season slow, partially due to a back injury, and partially because he was a 20-year-old in Double A. But he eventually got on track, and he hit .281, .350, .423 for the year. And he was basically consensus top 100 prospect in baseball, generally ranked, you know, between 25 and 50 by the major prospect sources at the time. And he was considered the Mets' third best prospect after Fernando Martinez and Mike Pelfrey.
Yikes.
Well, yeah. He was seen as a five-tool player. He had plus-plus speed, a good glove, good raw power, a decent ability, especially in relation to his age, to make contact. So there was a lot to like. And the Mets rushed him, as they did a lot of players during that period of time, and he made his major league debut on May 13th, 2007, at the tender age of 21, and he hit 232, 288, 304 in 58 games with the Mets, and clearly wasn't ready. But he wouldn't get any more chances with the Mets because he was packaged along with Diolis Guerra, Phil Umber, and Kevin Mulvey, and he was sent to the Twins in exchange for Johan Santana. He didn't perform well in Minnesota either. He was still just very raw. Over the course of two seasons, he hit 248, 293, 352, and he was eventually traded to the Brewers in exchange for J.J. Hardy in November of 2009. And he struggled in his first couple of years with the Brewers, but then in 2012, everything finally clicked. So basically, in his first 3 years with Milwaukee, he hit 248, 296, 415. In his last three, he was a two-time All-Star that got MVP votes, and he hit a cumulative 276, 338, 468 batting average. He was almost traded to the Mets in 2015 at the trade deadline, but as we all know, that fell through, and instead he was traded along with Mike Fiers to the Houston Astros in exchange for Josh Hader, Adrian Hauser, Brett Phillips, and Domingo Santana. Ignoring the injuries that Yoenis Cespedes has had in his career, in his Mets career, it was definitely a blessing in disguise that the Mets weren't able to trade for him because his career kind of cratered. He hit 221, 277, 342 in his season and a half in Houston, and then he got released. And he had a little bit of a resurgence when he signed with Texas. He hit 262, 345, 481 in basically a year and a couple of weeks with them. And then in 2018, he signed with the Tampa Bay Rays and again, wasn't very good. He hit 208, 298, 336. So, you know, it's kind of been an up and down career for Gomez. Probably rushed to the major leagues way too fast. And just wasn't really able to develop those tools. But,
We should also highlight the fact that the injury he got in Milwaukee at the beginning of the end of that peak was, I mean, hip labral injuries and labral injuries in general are just awful. Like, they're hard to treat. It's hard to recover from. It's really hard to ever get back to where you were before. It's very prone to arthritic development. So not a great way to go.
No, and he's you know, his time in Texas, I think it was 110 games total. You know, he's flashed being, you know, a decent hitter. His numbers in Syracuse this year, obviously they're AAA, but he's hitting 272, 331, 482, and that's with a 313 BABIP. So it's not like he's, you know, it's not like his numbers are crazy inflated and all an illusion. And let's be honest, Keon Broxton is currently hitting 152, 220, 147. I think that Carlos Gomez can do better than that.
Right, and like the one thing you'd be losing there is the defense that Broxton gives you, but you already have Juan Lagares on the team. You don't need two guys that do nothing but give you a good center field glove.
Right. I mean, Broxton has the reputation of being a good fielder, but just the amount of time that he's been in the field has really been so limited. I don't think it's really been a major difference.
Right. No, I definitely – like, what – to be clear, I don't think trading for Broxton was a bad move. Like, he's like Lagares, but in theory he had more speed, so you could use him as a pinch runner, and he also had power, so he could run into a ball every once in a while. But it looks like the bat speed is just gone, and they haven't used him as a pinch runner much, so I think you give the next man up a chance at some point because he's so redundant with Lagares. I could also just see them cutting Broxton loose to make room for Lowry, but the bench is kind of a mess right now anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they really traded. You know, it would be kind of sucky if they did just outright release Broxton because they did trade players to acquire him. But it's not like they traded much. They traded Bobby Wall, Adam Hill, and Felix Valerio. Yeah. And basically, Wall had the most upside of that group as possibly being, you know, a late innings kind of reliever.
I thought Hill was potentially something. Like, I was never particularly impressed with Wall, but I vaguely remember us talking about Hill as a marginally interesting mid-round pick at some point. But you're right, it's not much. There's nothing to worry about losing there, really.
Yeah, I mean, so if he is released, you just lost three players that probably were not going to amount to much.
I'm pretty sure Wall is still hurt anyway.
Yeah, he tore something or other.
Yeah.
As is the case has been in most of his career, he's injured somehow.
Yep.
And, I mean, worst case scenario, you cut him and you bring up Gomez, and Gomez doesn't really hit much. You know, you're rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. Nothing really changed.
Right.
At best case scenario, all of a sudden he's able to hit. You know, then you have maybe a solid bench piece, which the Mets are really lacking.
Yeah. Like, and it's the unfortunate thing is that they really need a left-handed bat on the bench, and Gomez doesn't solve that issue. But they do need right-hand hitting. Well, I'm looking at his platoon splits, and he doesn't even have splits really. So, Not a fit in that sense either. But right, he can't be any worse than Broxton has been at this point. And you don't need two glove only outfielders.
No, hopefully this situation resolves itself.
Hey, luckily, I mean, yeah, maybe Broxton just runs into three home runs next week and we look like idiots.
Yeah, that would be great. I would like a curse where we look like idiots because the players that we crap on suddenly do great. That's fine with me.
Everyone on the Mets is bad.
Well, our next player, the pitcher of the week, is actually the first player that is a repeat this season, and it is Harold Gonzalez. He threw one game, he started one game, and he went 6-plus innings, allowing no hits, no runs, walking 2, and striking out 6, and that was en route to the Binghamton Rumble Ponies first no-hitter. Ryder Ryan, he came in and finished things up. He threw 2 1/3 innings. And it was the first no-hitter in Binghamton history since July 23rd, 2006, when Miguel Pinedo, he threw one against the Portland Sea Dogs during a 7-inning doubleheader. And the crazy thing is that this is the 5th no-hitter in the Eastern League this year, and it's mid-May. First one was April 6th when Harrisburg Senators Eric Fetty, Jordan Mills, and Aaron Barrett threw a combined no-no against the Bowie Bay Sox. The next one was on April 24th when the Erie Seawolves had Alex Fajardo and Drew Carlton throw one against, again, the Bowie Bay Sox. And then literally the next day after that, Kyle Hart, Daniel McGrath, and Adam Lau on the Portland Sea Dogs threw one against the Rumble Ponies. And then on the 29th, at the end of April, Casey Mize threw one himself, the only no-hitter this season in the Eastern League that was thrown by just one individual, against the Altoona Curve. So the last time that the Eastern League had this many no-hitters was way back in 2003, when there were 5 spaced out, you know, across the entire season. And the record for most is 7 in 1967. And obviously no-hitters are a very fluky thing, so there's no way of predicting that there's going to be another one this season. But there's basically 3.5 months left to go, so there's definitely enough time. And the trends are actually on the right side. Pitching is extremely dominant in the Eastern League this year. So far, you know, and it is basically just a month and a few weeks in, but so far the league average batting line in the Eastern League is 234, 315, 358, with a 673 OPS. and the league average ERA is 3.58. In 2018, just last year, the league average OPS was 716, and the league average ERA was 4.01. So that's a 50-point, basically, fluctuation. In 2017, again, the OPS was 727, and the ERA was 4.03. And you have to go back to 2015 to get to a point where pitching was as dominant as it is right now. That year, the league average was 256, 319, 372 with a 691 OPS and a league average ERA of 3.67. So pitching is in right now in the Eastern League.
Maybe they need some of those juiced balls that AAA is getting right now, right?
Yeah, like, that is – I was looking. There's been no news or any kind of changes to Eastern League equipment. So that is a kind of – that is an interesting little tidbit that in Eastern League, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, pitching is extremely dominant. And then you just go up one level to AAA and hitters are just whacking the ball like never before.
Yeah, it's frightening some of the numbers that are happening in AAA. Interesting, like most of these guys putting up, most of the names you mentioned for these nose hitters are either legitimate prospects or guys who have seen major league time already. Like Fetty? I don't know, actually. Has seen time with the Nationals already and was a top prospect at one point. I mean, arguably still is a notable prospect. Fieto is a somewhat controversial but notable prospect for the Tigers. Mai is another really good prospect for the Tigers. So Harrell might be possibly the worst starter to get one of the no-hitters this season, which isn't an insult to Harrell, just lots of other notable guys.
Yeah, I think it's pretty solid that he is at the bottom rung of those names.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was the Portland Sea Dog one with Kyle Hart, McGrath, and Lau, right. So...
I already forgot his name.
Exactly.
He's a 26-year-old random starter in the Red Sox system, and they might have the worst farm in baseball. So not notable. We've talked about this a couple times already, but Harrell is fairly closer than we'd like him to be to the major league rotation. So seeing this kind of performance is at least marginally encouraging. It's like, oh, maybe he could survive for a little bit if he was thrown into the fire. But,
well, I mean, his performance this year is very different from his performance in AA last season.
Yeah.
I mean, he so far, it's only been four starts and then one relief appearance. It's only 25 innings, but he has a 2.88 ERA, and he has a very good walk rate and a strikeout per nine rate over, nine. So,
I mean, the strikeouts are way up. That's really interesting.
It also comes with a 2.18 BABIP, but, again, in the minor leagues, good, guys that are good have ways of making sure that BABIP is either really high if you're a hitter or low if you're a pitcher. So it's not really, it's just really an asterisk, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you regress that a bit, regress the lift on base a bit, it's a mid-three ERA with strikeouts pushing 11 per nine innings right now, which is a big step up.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder who's in the AAA rotation right now. It's Santiago and Flexen. Giannis, is Giannis still there, or did they send him down to AA?
I believe that he still is, but I don't recall him actually pitching after that debacle that he had a couple of days ago where he basically gave up like 13 runs, 10 earned, or something like that.
When your knuckleball's not working, it's ugly.
Yeah.
Point is, there's not like tons of guys blocking Harrell at AAA, so perhaps another... maybe three or four more good starts, and the Mets should probably move him up to AAA and see if he's a viable shuttle arm. Oh, Oswalt's going to be in that AAA rotation. And Zach Lee.
Zach Lee.
Yeah, Dodger prospects of years gone by. I'd like to see – hopefully Harrell can keep it going. He doesn't even need to be quite this good, just still solid, and then we'll see him in AAA in a couple months maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. I'm going to see Binghamton this week, and Harrell's probably going to be pitching on one of the days that I'm there. So it'll be interesting to see what exactly it is that he's doing differently now. Because
of course, you've said that, and now you've doomed yourself because you know it's going. Yep, it's all over now.
Oh well, there goes that thought.
Yeah. You're going to get, I don't even know who else is in that double A rotation.
Okay, Peterson, Harrell.
Okay, Dibrell is still in high A. You're going to get some random filler arm and like it.
I believe Chris Mazza.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, there is a pretty big drop.
60% of those arms are notable, though. So you
Michael Gibbons.
Oh, he got
and
shelled.
Chris Mazza, the two other guys, yeah.
Gibbons gave up 8 runs without getting an out, with getting one out this week. So, fingers crossed you don't get that.
Yeah, it could either be good or very ugly.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see, depending on how the weather is and everything this week. All right, well, we will be back after this.
Hey everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers though, don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays, and on Tuesdays we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individuals for particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lena Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president...
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime, from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to From Complex to Queens. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos. And this week, we are going to start our draft coverage. So we're going to kick off that in a minute, but I just want to announce the winner of our Copa de la Diversión contest. The winner of 2 tickets to a Brooklyn Cyclones game to be decided at a later point by me, and the winner is Alex Busso. So congratulations, Alex, and I'll be in contact and we'll figure out all the details. And I want to thank everybody else that sent in emails and entered the contest. And we'll be having another one in a few weeks, so everybody stay tuned. So the Mets will be picking 12th in the draft. They finished 4th place last year with a 77-85 record. And 12 is kind of an interesting spot, because the bona fide, you know, cream of the crop guys that you find at the top of the draft boards aren't really left. So you're starting to, like, pick and look at guys with decent upsides, but kind of noticeable flaws. Nothing necessarily major, but, you know, you're starting to see the cracks.
Would you agree that, and perhaps it's just a perception thing, but for the second straight year, it feels like their pick is right at the right after a tier ends. It felt like last year, I mean, obviously Kelenic has been huge, but it felt like there was a clear top five with all the college hitters, and then there was a bit of a drop, and that's where the Mets were. And this year it feels like...
Yep, I agree.
Yeah, so they've just gotten a little bit unlucky, it seems.
Last year, I think they were literally at that cutoff. This year, I think maybe it comes like 3 or 4 picks beforehand.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzier, and it's not. Yeah. It's, yeah.
But, I mean, there's still going to be good players available.
Mm-hmm.
So, who is the guy that, in your heart, you are interested in the Mets picking?
I want them to trade the entire system, convince MLB to change the rules, and let them draft Andrew Vaughn.
That's a good strategy.
We lobby MLB, we trade for the second overall pick and get Andrew Vaughn. More realistically, the guy, and there are a couple guys I was looking at, but the guy that most intrigued me was Brett, I don't know if it's Batty or Beatty. Beatty seems to make more sense, so I'm gonna go with that. He's a third baseman from Lake Travis High School in Austin, Texas. Fangraphs has him 14th on their board with a 45 future value. We can debate the merits of their system ad nauseum, but they're one of the biggest free suppliers of information for this stuff. MLB.com's recent mock draft had them going 19th to the Cardinals, and everything in that middle 10 is kind of fluid. So he's within the Mets' reasonable pick range. He's got great, one of the better hit power combinations in this draft. He's got a nice left-handed swing. He's been I saw a couple comparisons to Nolan Gorman, who the Cardinals took last year. Guy with some contact issues, but big power and some defensive questions at third base. Beatty was also the Gatorade Baseball Player of the Year last year in Texas, where he hit .435, had 12 home runs, walked 40 times. Yeah, it's like impressive production and a pro-ready frame. Looks like your prototypical slugging third baseman. He's got a good arm, but fringy range, right? And to me, in modern baseball, I'm okay living with someone with fringy range, especially at the hot corner. I mean, you can position better. You can train harder. Like Max Muncy has turned himself into an adequate infielder. So, but the most interesting part about Beatty to me is his age. And he's 19 and a half as a high schooler, which obviously is very old. It makes him older than some of the junior college prospects in this draft. And to me, so I could very easily see, and another article, I think Baseball America wrote an article about this, see that age, damaging his draft status, where teams are going to say, well, he's older than his class, so we can't really judge him, et cetera, et cetera. He hasn't put it up against pro caliber arms or college caliber arms, what have you. I have often argued, not with any real scouting basis because I'm not a scout, but that age, particularly age differences, which often come down to 6 months, 8 months, are sometimes overblown. Good performances will be kind of hand waved off because the guy is a little bit too old. Bad performances will be waved off a little bit because the guy's young for the level, right? And to me, that's always felt a little cheap. I think I think assigning blanket rules based on age is silly. And also, I don't mind if a guy needs to start his career a year older than everyone else, right? You're still going to, arguably, that's better under the current arbitration system because you're actually going to control prime years in the late 20s. So I feel like Beatty might be someone who gets a touch overlooked or a touch undervalued due to that age issue. And that's why I thought he was interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point about the age and everything like that. And honestly, when you're looking at guys that are like, 18 to 20 in that range, there really isn't that much on the average anyway. There isn't really that much of like mental or physical differences. It's not like the guys that are 20 are going to be the Hulk and, right. The guys that are 18 are nothing. I mean, I guess if you compare like a high schooler to like a college, like a freshman or whatever, like there's better facilities in college, right. So they have that opportunity to mm-hmm. get in better shape. But
That 100% I think is the bigger thing, that when you're in a college or pro environment, you're much more focused on baseball. You have access to much more equipment, better staff, et cetera, right? As opposed to, oh, I'm a year older in high school, so I'm a little bigger, but I still train in my home gym and spend 80% of my time in school or dealing with homework or all this other nonsense that isn't baseball. So I'm sure there are like actual merits to the worries about his age, but I think they might be a bit overblown, and perhaps that has maybe caused people to overlook what is a very talented high school bat.
Well, you make a convincing case.
And I like the way his swing looks. He's got a pretty left-handed swing, but I thought the load was fine. It's not too noisy or anything. But someone who actually is good at swing analysis can comment more on that.
Well, the guy that I'm going to be focusing on in this draft is someone that should be available at 12. And there were a few guys. I think you'll agree with me that there might not be like I was saying before, the cream of the crop guys. Mm-hmm. But there's a bunch of guys at 12 that are, you know, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy that I'm going with, and I'm going to my heart here, and I'm picking Jack Leiter. And
okay.
He's the son of Al Leiter, and Al is basically the one reliable pitcher that the Mets had, you know, in all of the late 90s and early 2000s. Jack's currently a senior at Del Barton, a private school in Morristown, which is in New Jersey. Last season, 2018, he posted a 0.64 ERA in 54.1 innings, walking 18 and striking out 77. And so far this year, he has regressed a little bit. He has a 0.83 ERA in 33.2 innings, allowing 11 walks and striking out 61. So when you factor in, you know, the very little, I think he pitched one game in his sophomore year. So when you factor in everything together, he has a cumulative 0.76 ERA in 92.1 innings, allowing 44 hits, walking 33, and striking out 143. So Morris County isn't exactly like a baseball hotbed, like SoCal, Texas, Bible Belt South, whatever. But the stuff is definitely legit. I wasn't able to get to see him, but Ken was. He went down to Del Barton last week when he pitched against Montville on May 4th. And the fastball sat in low to mid 90s, very consistently for four innings, and then it kind of backed up into the high 80s, low 90s in the fifth and the sixth. He topped out at 95, but he hit it multiple times in multiple innings, and then it also had some natural sink and some natural arm side run to it. The curveball and the slider are both high quality, probably plus or at least above average pitches, and then he also mixes in a changeup. The curveball is a mid to high 70s, like knee-buckling 12-6 bender. And he could throw it for strikes. He could throw it out of the zone to get guys to chase. And he's just able to basically put it wherever it feels like. Slider, not as impressive with the vertical movement. It doesn't really have much. But it's in the mid-80s, and it has very sharp, sudden horizontal break. It's almost like a cutter action. And then the changeup, he doesn't really throw it much, but he has a feel for it. And it's, you know, a solid enough base that when and if he needs to focus on it in the minors, it could become, you know, fringe to average pitch, which would give him, like, an above-average fastball, two above-average breaking balls, and then possibly an average-ish changeup. And the mechanics are nice. They're clean. He has a little bit of crossfire in his delivery. He has a little bit of deception in his mechanics. And he is 6'1", 195 pounds. So there's a little bit of room for him to possibly grow and add a little bit more muscle, which will give him more stamina. And that will keep that fastball velocity up in the low to mid-90s. But there's also the chance that he doesn't grow or add much muscle. So that is a little risky there. And another risk, the main risk really, is that he has a commitment to Vanderbilt. And Vandy, they always get their guy, and so it's going to be a tough commitment to break. But I think if any team has a shot, it is going to be the Mets for two reasons. One, Al Leiter, he quit his work as a broadcaster a couple of months ago, specifically to spend time with his family. And he accepted a position with the Mets a couple of months ago to be a scouting and player development advisor. So having a family member in the organization doesn't make a player a lock to sign. You know, Danny Alfonso was drafted last year and he didn't sign, despite the fact that Edgardo Alfonso is the Cyclones manager. But having a family member in the organization definitely can't hurt, especially when Al Leiter's job would be basically helping and coaching minor league guys at all levels, from newly drafted guys to the guys at the top. So that's one thing going in the Mets' favor. And the other is that they have a reputation, you know, of developing high-quality pitchers pretty much better than anyone else the last couple of years. You know, Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, Steven Matz, Zach Wheeler, Matt Harvey, all those guys came through the system, and at times those guys were flashing unhittable stuff. Some of them more frequently than others, but, you know, it's just those were all very good major league pitchers at certain points. And if a young pitcher is interested in getting the most out of his potential, the Mets system with all the coaches and everything is one of the best places to do it. So 12 might be an overreach for Leiter, but at the same time, I don't know if he would be available in the second round. You know, the Mets would be picking in like the 40s or so. And I don't know. Most of the guys that are available at 12 or probably will be, they don't really feel like they have as much upside as Leiter might. So, you know, new GM, he might want to try to be bold with his first pick. So, you know, if he's going to shoot his shot and go for the guy that might have the most difference maker potential, I think that Leiter might be that guy.
I think that's all very fair. I mean, Leiter was definitely someone I was interested in. I'm generally not a big fan of first round prep pitchers, but outside of the top 10, it's kind of just who do you think is going to be the best. So I wouldn't hate it. And the stuff is there, like the fast, he's got premium velocity, the breaker's there. I think it would be a decent pick. And the unfortunate thing is that even if it is a reach, you're probably not going to get much of an underslot signing to float some money to later picks because of that strong Vanderbilt commit.
Oh yeah, they're going over slot and very much so if they want to lure him out from that commitment.
Is I don't think it is, but Vanderbilt isn't a school with a reputation for abusing its arms, right?
No, I wouldn't say so.
I mean, it's not Rice or UConn or what's the other one? Slipping my mind at the moment. There's always three big offenders I think of, but it's not Vanderbilt, so that's not really something to wave convince him of. Who was Kenny going to talk about? Was he going to?
Yep, Kenny being very diligent and everything, he sent us a recording, and Kenny's pick was Zach Thompson. So Kenny, go right ahead and tell us about him.
Hello from Complex the Queens listeners. This is Ken Lavin, and today I'd like to talk about a potential draft pick that the Mets have been linked to from a few different media outlets. Guy who they've been linked to with the 12th overall pick, and that's Zach Thompson, a left-handed starting pitcher from the University of Kentucky. Thompson is a, you know, tall lefty, not all that dissimilar from 2017 first-round selection David Peterson or 2016 first-round selection Anthony Kay, in that he's sort of a lower ceiling, higher floor. They call them crafty lefties. So Thompson was born in Anderson, Indiana, and pitched for Wapahani High School in Selma, Indiana, where he struck out 119 batters in 56 innings as a senior. He was originally drafted by the Tampa Bay Rays in the 11th round of the 2016 draft, but chose to honor his commitment to the University of Kentucky. And, he shoved in his freshman year there, posting a 3.545 ERA in 75.2 innings and striking out 96 against 38 walks. That's 11.42 K per nine against 4.52 walks per nine. And he struggled in his sophomore season. He posted a 4.94 ERA in 31 innings, striking out only 42 and walking 20. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes, Thompson missed a full 2 months due to an elbow injury in his sophomore season. And he returned this season and has pitched generally pretty well, posting a 2.08 ERA in 78 innings pitched across 12 starts so far this year. And striking out 113 against 30 walks. That's 13.03 K per nine against 3.46 walks per nine. He's been pretty great as the Wildcats ace this season. He's been basically the only or one of the very few upperclassmen on the team that had a lot of guys leave for the draft and graduation last year. Kentucky's leaned pretty hard on him to win them games, especially in conference. So there's a lot to like with Thompson. He's pretty polished. You can think of him as very similar to David Peterson. They have similar arm slots. Thompson throws a little bit harder than Peterson did at the time of the draft. He throws about 91 to 94 with the fastball. I've seen him touch a little higher on ESPN. A few of their games have been televised. And in addition to the fastball, he throws two distinct breaking balls, a slider in the low to mid-80s that looks pretty good when it's at the higher end of that velocity range and gets a little slurvy at the lower end, and a slower curve that sits in the high 70s that he likes to steal strikes with. The two breaking balls have a tendency to bleed together, and I'm pretty sure that whatever team ends up drafting him is probably going to have him scrap one and focus solely on the other and getting the other, you know, as good as it can possibly be. He also supposedly throws a changeup, but I haven't really seen him rely on it too much in a few starts, again, that I've seen on ESPN and other places, so I'm not putting much stock in that. While there's some good there, there's also some things to be wary about. With Thompson, he still is working on learning how to harness his stuff. The command is a work in progress, as his 3.45 walks per nine attests to. He probably should be able to dominate a little more without the walks, given just his level of raw stuff in, you know, against, you know, college, you know, level hitters. But the breaking pitches tend to bleed together. He doesn't always throw them super consistently, and he just has a tendency to lose the zone from time to time. The biggest red flag for Thompson is that he has quite a lengthy injury history. As I said earlier, he missed a full 2 months in his sophomore season to an elbow injury, which for any pitcher is a pretty big red flag. And this season, as Kentucky's ace, he's been pushed very hard to win them games. I saw somewhere on Twitter that in his last start against Arkansas, I believe on May 5th, he threw upwards of 120 pitches to help secure them the win. It was the second game of a doubleheader, so there's some reason why you would push your starter a little bit harder, but still, 120 pitches in an outing is a lot, and I wouldn't generally think that you would want to push a guy that hard with, you know, the injury history that he has. So my thoughts on taking a pitcher like Thompson that high in the draft, the 12th pick, is it kind of reminds me of the Mets, you know, draft choice when they chose Anthony Kay in 2016. You know, they're both polished college lefties with durability concerns. Kay ended up needing surgery immediately after the draft and missed his entire season, and has kind of moved slowly ever since as they've tried to build up innings and everything after surgery. And generally, I think that it's a profile best avoided that early. You've got a guy who, you know, doesn't necessarily have top-of-the-rotation potential, and the value of drafting that guy is that you can get him to the big leagues relatively quickly. Now, his injury history being what it is, there's a risk that he's going to miss significant time due to some type of elbow injury in the near future, which would slow that down. So you, essentially what you're drafting is a, you know, a high floor, low ceiling pick that might take a little while just from his elbow being able to withstand a starter's workload. So in my opinion, I think that there's probably, you know, going to be better options on the board at 12. I'd rather them go with somebody who has a little more upside than a high floor college pitching prospect that, you know, seems to be a profile that they really enjoy. That being said, they could probably do a lot worse than Zach Thompson at number 12. You know, there's some pitchability there. I could see the changeup getting a little better once he gets into pro ball and, you know, doesn't need to or will need a third pitch to turn around a lineup multiple times. Like I said, they could do a lot worse, but with the injury risk, there's definitely some red flags in the profile. So, all right, well, that was our discussion of Zach Thompson, and thank you so much.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed, their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
All right, so that is our three draft hopefuls. So
I had a joke I forgot to make, unfortunately, and now it's going to be lame.
Well, go ahead anyway.
Van Wagenen only wants to acquire third baseman, right? So he should definitely draft Beatty. Given that everyone that got this offseason is now playing at third base.
That is very true. But he's not kind of old and washed up, so...
That's also Davis isn't old and washed up, but we're still not convinced on Davis. Noted.
No, definitely not. He's old, but I guess he's washed up. I don't know. Well, speaking of old and washed up players, I guess that's a good segue to oh yeah, that guy.
Oh, that is perfect. Nice.
Yep.
For what we had, that's the best segue we've had into this.
I think so.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Sure. Well, oh yeah, my that guy for this week is Greg Peavy. On May 7th in 2014, he pitched a 9-inning shutout against the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. He scattered a pair of hits, but he didn't allow any runs. He didn't walk anybody, and he struck out 6. So Peavy was drafted by the Mets in the 6th round in 2010, and he was actually picked twice before that, once out of high school in 2007 in the 24th round by the Yankees, and then when he was a sophomore, he was eligible for the draft, and he was picked by the Astros. Him and the Mets, they came to terms on a contract literally an hour before the deadline, and he did get a nice bonus out of that. It was a $200,000 signing bonus. But he wasn't able to make his professional debut that year as a result. So he was kind of not a year late, but he missed a couple of months.
A year late and a couple dollars ahead.
Yeah, yeah. He probably would have pitched for, you know, Brooklyn anyway. It would have been some 30 meaningless innings. So it probably didn't really affect him much at all. When he did make his professional debut, he was assigned to the Savannah Sad Nats. And then he made his way to St. Lucie midway through the year, and he was pretty solid. He posted a 3.47 ERA in 137 innings. He was assigned to Binghamton the next year, which is 2012. And like a lot of other guys, you know, the jump from the lower levels of the minors to the upper levels was a big one. And PV pretty much spent the next couple of years shuttling between Binghamton and the Las Vegas 51s, posting bloated ERAs in the fours and fives. He did have one good year though. 2014, he won Binghamton Pitcher of the Year honors. And that year he went 11-3 with a 2.94 ERA in 115 innings. But that was basically the high watermark for him. That winter in 2014, at the GM meetings, he was selected by the Twins in the minor league portion of the Rule 5 draft. And he was assigned to the Chattanooga Lookouts, which are the Twins' double-A team, and then the Rochester Red Wings, their triple-A team. But pretty much like with the Mets, he was overmatched in the Southern League and the International League. And Minnesota released him after that 1 year. And he's been working as a coach for the Northwest Futures Baseball Academy ever since. And the main reason why PV didn't really take to the upper levels of the minors is that his stuff was just underwhelming. He was mainly a fastball slider guy and was considered kind of intriguing as a prep arm, but his stuff just didn't really develop. His fastball basically sat in the high 80s to low 90s and could get as high as 94, and his slider flashed above average, but by the time he was in the later stage of his career, his fastball was sitting in the upper 80s, touching like 91, 92, and his slider really hadn't progressed. It still kind of flashed. So he just didn't really have anything in the tank at that point.
Another Met draft pick arm coming up short.
Yep, a lot of those.
So my guy actually is another tie-in with Carlos Gomez, particularly after that tidbit about him actually signing in 2002, which I didn't know. So I was looking at Bobby Malik. He was a center fielder drafted in the fourth round of the 2002 draft. Same year the Mets took Kazmir in the first, then didn't have picks for the second and third. Back in 2006, See, every week I have my Fangraphs page open with this, and then I inevitably close it in the midst of our other discussions and have to scramble to reopen it. Here we go. So from the 1st of May to the 12th of May in 2006, he had two homers and 42 at-bats. The advanced stats, he was 286, 333, 548, and 881 OPS, and a 147 weighted. So a nice little two-week stretch. Ultimately, he never made it past double A, really. He got a brief cup of coffee in triple A in 2006, but fizzled out there. I think there were some injuries mixed in as well. He didn't really play much at all in 2007. Wound up with the Dodgers for 65 plate appearances at their double A affiliate in 2008. And, after that, was out of baseball. Oddly, while I was, reading about this guy, I found that he is now a multi-unit franchisee for Jimmy John's in Florida. And no, I'm not making that up. I found a podcast where he's talking about being a baseball player to a multi-unit franchisee.
It's always kind of weird to see guys that were minor league players then, obviously if you don't make it, you need to, you know, you're not lasting on whatever your signing bonus was, mm-hmm. and your paltry minor league salary. It's always kind of jarring to see guys that you either knew or knew of or whatever from baseball then have to kind of transition back into regular society, you know, whatever right. you want to call it.
Right, right. I mean, he was a really good college baseball player. He was a three-time All-American. He was a Big Ten Baseball Player of the Year twice or once for Michigan State. So, like, he had a real successful career before being drafted. And, I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of guys who struggle to put things together after their baseball life ends. So good for him on finding a way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there have been more than their fair share of guys that have become, you know, alcoholics and whatever else, bad mm-hmm. things, because, mm-hmm. you know, they were at the pinnacle, and then now they're just regular Joes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, apparently the reason he moved into owning Jimmy John's or franchising Jimmy John's is because that is what he would eat in college, which is this is just like
the, yeah, I mean, there's continuity.
I'm just glad this exists, that this content exists out there.
Probably not many other places that you are learning little tidbits like that.
Uh-huh.
Well, he's a Jimmy John's franchisee. Carlos Gomez built coffins. This is just a very educational day today.
Uh-huh. Talents outside of baseball.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any other last words for the week?
Just a happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. Hope everyone's, the weather's not great in New York City, but hope everyone had a good time anyway.
Those are very good last words. Well, if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, send us an email from complextoqueens1word@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter. You can ask us questions there. You can make rude comments, whatever you like. I am at Steve Sipa. Lucas is at lvlahos343, and Ken is at kenlevin91. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it, review it, leave us comments, whatever you want to do, and thank you for listening. And we will be back next week to recap the fifth week of the 2019 minor league season.